Let's talk about the typical tax return forms the average retiree gets and what those forms mean in this, the 66th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Hey everyone, how you doing? I'm all right, thanks for asking. So today we are in the thick of tax return season. When this episode gets released, it is March 16th, 2023. By this point in the year, almost all of you listening should have all the documents you need to do your 2022 tax return. There may be some stragglers or holdover documents. Some documents may potentially get revised, amended, so you may get a surprise in the mail. There are some forms like a 5498 that I'll touch on that you may not have yet, but you might not actually technically need to do your return. We're going to go through the common forms that the, let's just say, average retiree or typical retiree is likely to see, or at some point, you know, may not see all these, but some of these forms at least are very likely to see. I'm going to go through what they are at a high level, what they're for. So hopefully you can make a little more sense. If you do your own taxes, you probably already know these things, but if you don't do your own taxes, you at least now can have a better appreciation for what these forms are, why they're important, and why your tax return preparer ultimately needs them. Should be fun. Now, many of you may have already have your tax returns done. Again, March 16th by the time this comes out. I know lots of folks are eager beavers and hop on it as soon as they get all their documents. So for you all, this may be a little old at this point, but for everyone else who's either procrastinating or simply hasn't gotten all their forms yet, maybe this will provide some useful, helpful info for this current tax year. So let's give this a shot, see what happens. But first, some super, super exciting news. The Retirement Planning Education Podcast has a limited engagement sponsorship with a good friend of mine, Boomer Benefits. So Boomer Benefits is a Medicare agency, you know, Medicare insurance agency based out of Dallas-Fort Worth area, but can work with people throughout the country. I believe maybe all but New York, although last I talked with them, I think New York was pending. But for time being, at least they can work with folks in 49 states. So I've pretty good friends with them. I've met the founder, Danielle Roberts. She and I have spoken at the same conference before, you know, met in person, really, really, really cool person. And I refer to them a lot myself for information, and I refer other folks to them. They have a really great Facebook group. I mean, you all know me. You know I'm big into Facebook groups with the Retirement Planning Education Group. Boomer Benefits has one as well called Medicare Q&A with Boomer Benefits is the technical name. Not that I'm counting, but as of today, it is about 47,000 people, whereas my group is just shy of 40. We were kind of neck and neck for a while, but they last year or so, the Medicare Q&A Boomer Benefits groups have been pulling away from me. Good for them. But what's cool about it is just like my Facebook group and their group, you can go there to get questions for any sort of Medicare. Get answers for any sort of Medicare question you may have. I've asked things there myself personally, you know, throughout the last few years, even before being in a sponsorship partnership with them. But great group. What's nice about it is they have staff whose job it is to oversee the group, to answer questions, to moderate it, et cetera. So for the most part, 24/7. Now, you know, if you ask a question 3 a.m. in the morning on a Sunday, you may not get an answer quickly. Who knows? Maybe you do. But point is, they do have, it's a big organization. They do have paid staff who answer questions quickly, diligently, thoroughly. Like I said, I've asked stuff myself and got great answers. And I refer within my Facebook group all the time. Anytime there's a prickly, not even prickly, but any sort of Medicare question, I will and have for years refer people to the their group, again, Medicare Q&A with Boomer Benefits. So definitely check that out if you're not. If you're not on Facebook and you are interested in learning more about Medicare, this is a good reason to get on Facebook. You can tune out the rest of the noise. You don't have to mess around with all the other goofiness on Facebook. But the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, wink, wink, and Medicare Q&A with Boomer Benefits, both places I would highly recommend anyone interested in learning or learning more about retirement and Medicare, check those places out. So let's get on with it with this episode. So again, this is about the common forms you may get in the mail or download from websites for the end of your tax reporting to do your tax return. So let's just get into it. Again, this is for the typical retiree. So some of these things won't apply. You may never see them, but I thought I'd at least bring them up for the fun of it, just for educational purposes. So first would be the form W-2. Now, anyone who worked for someone else, not as an independent contractor, but you worked as an employee, you would have gotten this at some point during your career. Now you're retired, you probably stopped getting it, but some people even in retirement have part-time gigs, or you're transitioning to retirement. So you know what this is. This reports your wages for the year. There's a lot of boxes on there. It reports your gross wages. It reports your wages subject to Social Security, Medicare tax. It reports your federal income tax withheld, your state income tax withheld, if any. There's a whole bunch of other boxes that show different things, like if you contributed to a health savings account through your payroll deductions, if you contributed to 401k, the cost of your employer-sponsored health insurance, blah, 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 all sorts of things. That's a W-2. And all these forms, I should say, ultimately feed into your tax return, which is Form 1040, and dozens, if not hundreds, depending how complicated your life is, of supplementary forms and schedules and attachments and stuff. But I'm not getting into the tax return itself. I'm just getting into the inputs to the tax return in today's episode. So Form W-2 reports wages from employment. Next, Form 1099s. There's a whole bunch of them, and I'll step through them. But in a nutshell, 1099s are forms that, best way to put it, they report any money you received or transactions that could potentially be taxable or have tax implications, potential tax implications for you. So there's various flavors of 1099s. Again, I'm going to speak to these from the perspective of a kind of typical retiree. First is the SSA 1099. That simply is the one that reports any Social Security benefits you receive. It shows the gross benefits received. It'll show the federal taxes withheld, if any. And it'll show Medicare premiums paid if you are on Medicare and have had your Medicare premiums deducted from Social Security. That would show that on there. So that's SSA 1099. Next is 1099-R. This is a big one. And you can have these or get these for a few different reasons. The R stands for retirement, I believe. I assume it does. I don't know for certain. I'd be surprised if it didn't. Let's put it that way. So 1099-R stands for retirement distribution. It is any distribution from a retirement plan, such as a IRA, a Roth IRA, or employer retirement plans like a 401k, 403b, 457, the federal thrift savings plan. If you have a pension, a traditional pension, it'll get shown or reflected to you on a 1099-R for the year. Or an annuity. Distributions you take from an annuity will show up here. So 1099-R show a bunch of things, kind of loosely similar to W-2 in that they show a lot. It'll show the gross amount of the distribution. It'll show the taxable amount to the extent that's different. So for example, some people have a pension. There's a gross amount of annual pension they receive, but not all of it's taxable. Maybe some of the money is a return of their own buy-in. So for example, if you work at an employee that has a traditional pension, they may require you to pay some into that pension. To the extent you do, some portion of your eventual payment from that pension will be not taxable. So that's why there can be a difference between gross amount and taxable amount. Here's a fun one. There's also a little checkbox on there. It says taxable amount not determined. That is commonly flagged yes or checked X, checked on, whatever, when it comes to like IRAs, distributions from IRAs, because it's a topic for another episode, I suppose. But the custodian of the IRA, the account, where your account's held, be it Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard or TD or whatever, they don't really know how much of it's taxable. The taxability of IRA distributions is between you and the IRS to keep tabs on. Custodian just simply holds the money, right? They don't know that money you put in was or wasn't tax deductible, et cetera. They just know you put money in, they send you money out. It's on you to figure out what's taxable. So that taxable amount not determined is often flagged on. It's ultimately on you to figure out whether or not it's taxable. 1099-R also shows federal tax withheld. It'll show state tax withheld if you had any state tax withheld. There's also a little box to check yes, whether or not it's an IRA or not. And why does that matter? So on your Form 1040 tax return, there'll be two different lines for retirement distributions. Well, there's a few. There's one just for Social Security, but there'll be one just for IRAs. There's another one that'll say pensions and annuities. That little box on the 1099-R that checks yes if it's an IRA, that's what makes that distribution feed into the IRA line on your 1040. Otherwise, if not, it's going to flow into the pension and annuity line by default. Now, it might seem a little bit of a misnomer if you have a 401k, for example, and you take a distribution out of that. That distribution is going to show up on your 1040 as a pension and annuity distribution. You may be like, well, it's not. It's not an annuity. It's not a pension. Well, technically correct. Well, it sort of is. In IRS speak, it's ultimately a pension. It's a form of pension, even though not in the traditional sense that you and I know a pension to be. a 401k or a 403b is viewed as a pension, and it gets reported as such on the 1040. Another thing to take note of on 1099R, there's box 7 that could have a whole host of codes. There's a few different codes. And on the 1099R, there'll be a little chart explaining what all those codes mean. It helps denote the potential taxability of that, whether or not it may be subject to penalty. So for example, there's a code to denote a premature distribution. So if you're under 59 and a half, generally speaking, distributions from qualified retirement plans like IRAs, 401ks, et cetera, are subject to a penalty. So if you're under 59 and a half, you take a distribution just because it's going to be flagged as a premature distribution in that box 7 code. If you're over 59 and a half, it'll typically say normal distribution. If it's an inherited account, there's a code to denote death, you know, the distributions due to death. If it's a rollover, like you're rolling over money from your 401k to your IRA, there's a separate code for that to denote it's a rollover. If you made an excess contribution to an IRA or a Roth IRA, for example, and you remove that contribution, there'll be a specific code just for that. So pay attention to that. It's kind of like digging into someone's DNA almost. That box 7 could tell you a lot, potentially, depending what, you know, what the distribution is. So that's 1099Rs. And you could, like I said, you could have various ones of these. Let's say you have three different IRAs, one at Fidelity, one at Schwab, one at Vanguard. You take distributions from each, you will get a 1099R from each of those. Throw on top of it, maybe you got a little pension. You'll get a separate 1099R from that. So you could potentially have a whole gaggle of papers and forms that you get at tax return time from these various accounts. Next form of 1099 is a 1099-INT or INT that stands for interest. Simply, this is just interest you get from a bank. I think it shows box 1 of that. And that's really all that's on these forms commonly. There's other boxes there, but they're usually empty. One thing you may see if you do have an early withdrawal penalty on one of your bank accounts. For example, you have a certificate of deposit. It's a 1-year CD. And you terminate it 3 months in for whatever reason, there might be a penalty you have to pay. That penalty will get shown on your 1099-INT. Why does that matter? Well, because any penalties you have to pay for early withdrawal from bank products, that reduces that amount of that penalty, reduces your gross income on your tax return. So it saves you a little bit of taxes, all said and done. Rarely have I seen federal taxes withheld from banks, but if to the extent you did that federal tax withheld, there's a spot for that on 1099-INT. Next, 1099-DIV or DIV, which stands for dividends. If you have, you own stocks, and I should say this 1099-INT, this 1099-DIV, for example, these only apply to what are technically called non-qualified accounts. Non-qualified means it's not an IRA, it's not a Roth IRA, it's not a 401k, because, not to get too off on a tangent here, but those things aren't taxed. Like if you get interest within an IRA, that's not taxable to you in the year that happens. If you get a dividend paid on a stock held within your IRA, that dividend is not taxable to you in the year it happens. Because with IRAs, you're only taxed or potentially taxed when the money comes out, right? The current year activity doesn't generate tax implications within the account. So these are just normal bank accounts, normal brokerage accounts, or in the case of 1099-DIV, you own stock directly from a company, you know, just in the normal sense of ownership, not through an IRA or something. So 1099-DIV will show, like I said, dividends from stocks. Or if you have a life insurance policy that pays dividends, you may potentially get a 1099-DIV for that if some of that dividend is taxable. Other things on here, it'll show if the dividend is ordinary versus qualified. Again, another slightly technical thing. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but ordinary dividends are all dividends. A subset of that is what's called qualified dividends. There's more to it than this, but basically it is, think about it this way. All dividends paid on US stocks, let's just keep it simple, are generally considered qualified dividends. There's some holding periods around it and stuff, but normally if you're a buy and hold investor, for all intents and purposes, think about any dividend you get on US stocks will be qualified. Why does that matter? Well, because qualified dividends are taxed at a lower rate than ordinary dividends are. And on your 1040 tax return, you will see there's two different lines for ordinary versus qualified dividends. 1099-DIV will also show capital gain distributions. If you hold mutual funds in a non-qualified account, again, non-IRA account, and it pays what's called capital gain distributions, that's basically gains that the fund has within the fund, and it passes those gains on to you, the fund holder. That's reported here, as are if you get any dividends on REITs or REITs, which stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. That's reported on 1099-DIV, and any foreign tax you had withheld. So you may not even know this happens, but if you own shares of a foreign company, or you own an international mutual fund that has stocks of a bunch of non-US companies, those stocks pay dividends. Well, a lot of countries have mandatory tax withholding for foreigners. So like if you get, I'm making this up, I don't know if this is the actual rule for Germany, let's say, but if you own stocks of BMW, I don't even know if that's publicly traded. Let's assume it is. So you own stocks at BMW, pays a dividend, you get paid the dividend. Germany may mandatorily withhold, what I'm making this up, you know, 10% tax on that dividend because you're not a German person, you're a US person. So you have some tax, the broker, the custodian of your account will withhold it for you and pay it to Germany in this case. But you get credit for that. So that foreign tax withheld goes on your tax return. You can get a credit for some or all of that tax paid. So you're not double taxed in essence. A lot of countries have these sort of treaties and agreements with each other. Germany says, hey, we're going to tax people that have German dividends. The US says, okay, cool. You already taxed them. We're not going to hit them again. So we'll let them get a credit for the taxes paid to that. So that's 1099-DIV. 1099-B, where B stands for broker. These are any sales or transactions you have in a broker or barter exchange transaction. I've never seen a barter exchange in real life. I've only heard about it. But this is like if you have a broker transaction. You probably won't see these a lot. Hold that thought. These are usually rolled into what's called a consolidated 1099. But if you do have a one-off brokered transaction that's not through a typical brokerage account, like, again, a Schwab, a Fidelity, a Vanguard, a TD, you may get a 1099-B showing that transaction. Next is 1099-OID, which stands for original issue discount. This is if you buy a bond. This gets a little technical, but bonds have a face value. If you call back to the episode I did about bonds a handful of episodes ago on my intro to investing thing, if a bond has $1,000 face value and you buy it at a discount, let's say you buy it at $900, you have $100 discount when you buy that bond. That $100 discount isn't taxed to you all at once at the end. Instead, you realize a little bit of gain on that $100 throughout the life you own the bond. That's called original issue discount, where each year you'll get a 1099 OID showing that year's portion of that gain that you're slowly recognizing throughout the course of the life of the bond. All right, so consolidated 1099. This is if you do have a brokerage account at a broker, like a Fidelity, Schwab, TD, whatever. It's called the consolidated 1099 because it rolls in a bunch of the 1099s I just mentioned. It'll be a 1099 DIV, a 1099 INT, a 1099B, a 1099 OID, all wrapped into one big statement. It's often multiple pages. If you have a lot of transactions, it could be dozens of pages or more. So you'll see on there, there'll be sections broken out. There'll be a section called 1099 DIV. There'll be a section called 1099 INT, et cetera. So it just rolls all this stuff up into one big fat statement because all these different forms of activity, dividends, interest, brokerage transactions are all happening within this one account you have at Fidelity, Schwab, TD, Vanguard. Hence, they do you a solid and roll it all into one consolidated account. Next, 1099 MISC, or MIC, stands for miscellaneous. This is basically kind of a catch-all, not a catch-all. There's other forms. I probably should say this till the end, but there's other specific 1099s I'll mention that aren't captured here. But if they're not, then this is sort of a catch-all, 1099 MIS for miscellaneous. It's basically other random forms of income that are not subject to self-employment tax. For example, rents could be shown on there, royalties, other income, fishing boat proceeds, crop insurance proceeds, fish purchased for resale. Yes, these are actual labels within 1099 MISC. I've never seen anyone get fish purchased for resale, but I guess if you are in the fishmongering business, then perhaps this will come into play. Next, 1099 NEC, which stands for non-employee compensation. So just like 1099 MISC was sort of random income that isn't subject to self-employment tax, 1099 NEC is income that likely is subject to self-employment tax. So where would you see this? If you are an independent contractor or consultant and you work for someone, not as a full-blown employee, but just as a, you know, outside kind of paid by the hour consultant or contractor, the money they pay you will be reported on a 1099-NEC. Now, technically, I don't think they have to report it to you on this form unless it's $600 or more, or maybe over 600. You still, if you don't get one of these forms, you still have to report any income you got because that's, IRS says so. But, if you did get 600 or more of consulting contracting income, you will get a 1099, or you should get a 1099 NEC from the payer, the person you provide the services to. And then that is likely subject to self-employment tax, because if you're a consultant or a contractor, you're technically your own employer. So you do need to pay self-employment tax on that. Next, 1099-G, which stands for government. And that's most commonly if you get a refund of state income taxes, it'll show up there. So for example, you're doing your 2022 tax return now. It ends up you get a refund from your state. That refund will be paid to you during 2023. So then in early 2024, you will get a 1099-G from your state showing the refund that was paid to you in 2023. Also, if you get unemployment benefits, those show up on a 1099-G as well. Next, 1099-SA. This is if you get a distribution from a health savings account or HSA, for example. So it's another sort of qualified tax special plan, just like an IRA. Anytime you get a distribution from an IRA, it's reported on a 1099-R. Anytime you get a distribution from an HSA, it's reported on a 1099-SA. I forgot to mention, going back to 1099-R and IRAs, if you do a Roth conversion, for example, even though the money that you convert doesn't technically come into your hands, like if you take an outright distribution from an IRA, it lands into your bank account or whatever, you do a Roth conversion, the money doesn't directly come to you, but it does leave your IRA nonetheless and goes into a Roth IRA. So Roth conversions will also be reflected on a 1099-R. Sorry for stepping back there. I just kind of jogged my memory, came to me. All right, going back. So we left off 1099-SA, distributions from HSA. 1099-LTC, it is distributions or I guess benefits paid from a long-term care insurance policy. 1099-Q, a lot of you may not see a lot of these, but 1099-Q is if you get a distribution from a qualified education program, like a 529 plan. So for example, if you are helping support your kids or grandkids in their pursuit to pay for college, you may own a 529 where the child, the student is the beneficiary of it. So if that account is technically your name and a distribution comes out to pay for the kid's school, you're going to be the one to get the 1099-Q showing the distribution from that 529 plan. Not to make this episode about 529s, but if the distribution is to cover qualified education expenses, none of that distribution is going to be taxable. If it is not, you take it out just because, well, I got nothing else to do with it, so let me take it out and burn it, spend it. You will have to pay tax on a portion of that distribution that's specifically earnings from the account. And there's also a potentially penalty as well, again, if used for non-qualified, not for educational purposes. And there's a few other 1099s that you're really not likely to see. One is 1099-S, which is sale of property. So technically, anytime you sell a house, whether it's your primary residence or like an investment property, you're supposed to get a 1099-S to report that sale. In reality, it's rare. Now, I frankly don't know who exactly is responsible for generating these. I guess it depends, but I think if they do generate, it's supposed to be from the the title company or their lawyer that does the closing of the sale of the property. Maybe it's a realtor. I don't think it's a realtor. I think it's a lawyer or title company. Whoever's a closing agent for the property, I believe is the one who's supposed to do it. In reality, you rarely get it. I mean, I've personally sold two rental properties and a primary residence. Did not get a 1099-S for any of them. I've witnessed firsthand other people sell properties, again, rentals and or primary residence, did not get a 1099-S. I have seen some, but I would say it's the exception, not the norm. Now, maybe different states are slightly different. In New Jersey, they don't seem to be common for some reason. I don't know if that means closing agents are lazy or just, state specific. It shouldn't be. It's an IRS thing. It's, just like 1099-B reports the proceeds of a sale of like a brokerage transaction, 1099-S reports the proceeds of a sale of a house, a physical property. So anyway, so if you do get that, that's what that's for. If it is your primary residence, quite often it's not actually taxable because there's an exclusion, a gain exclusion, $250,000 for single folks, $500,000 for married filing joint folks. Maybe I'll do a separate episode on that at one point. But just know 1099-S reports the sale of a property. 1099-K, payment from third-party networks. This will be more common. This is like if you get a large payment from PayPal or Venmo or eBay, I guess. That might be PayPal. It's currently sort of in a holding pattern. There was new regulation that said anyone who gets more than 600 or maybe 600 or more, total payment sent to them from like a Venmo or a PayPal is going to get a 1099-K. And everyone's like up in arms. Now, I believe, I don't know if this was ironed out, but I think you'd only get that if the account you have set up with PayPal or Venmo or whatever is designated as a business account, because the government doesn't want people skirting around reporting income by, you know, accepting money through Venmo or something. So I'm pretty confident for business accounts, the cutoff of $600 or more, you'll get this 1099-K. And the IRS gets copies of all these things, I should say. So any 1099, IRS gets a copy of. So if you get it, rest assured they get it. So you better report whatever's on it. Otherwise, they got a computer matching system that will find it and will flag to you, hey, you know, it looks like you forgot some income here. But anyway, so this 1099-K thing, a lot of people were thinking that their own personal transactions, like, you know, you sent someone $15 to reimburse them for whatever dinner at Applebee's that you split. People were concerned that if they have $600 of income or payments from a third party network, that they're going to get one of these and it's going to really mess up their tax returns. Well, A, I think it only applied to business accounts, and B, the government did put a hold on it. The prior threshold, I want to say, was $10,000 more in a year, then you get a 1099-K. For now, I think they waived the $600 limit just because it was so unclear how this is going to impact folks. So stay tuned to be determined how that plays out. And the final 1099 I want to talk about is the 1099-C, which stands for cancellation of debt. I've never saw one of these in real life, but they exist. It is if you have, you know, someone gives you a loan, you're supposed to pay it back, you don't. That cancellation of debt is technically income because you're getting something that you weren't supposed to, right? If you were obligated to pay someone $100,000 in loan and they just let you walk away from it, well, you now have to report $100,000 of income on that cancellation of debt. And that would show up on a 1099-C. All right, that's the 1099s. We're getting kind of toward the end here. Forms 5498. This is IRA contribution information. So just like 1099-R shows anytime any money leaves an IRA or a Roth IRA, 5498 shows anytime money comes into an IRA or Roth IRA. So if you make a contribution to an IRA or Roth IRA, you're going to get a form 5498 showing that contribution. If you do a conversion out of an IRA into a Roth IRA, you're going to get, quiz time, you're going to get a 1099-R showing the money that left the traditional IRA, and then you're going to get a 5498 showing the money that went into the Roth IRA. Pretty cool, right? See how this stuff all ties together. The 5498 also shows the type of account it is, whether it's a Roth IRA or IRA, and it shows the year-end balance of the account. Why does that matter? So for if you're of an age where you need to take required minimum distributions or RMDs, those are based on the prior year's December 31st balance of the account. It's this form 5498 that's the formal reporting to the IRS of what your various IRAs, you know, the Roth IRAs, what their end of year account balances are. So again, the IRS gets a copy of this form just like they get a copy of 1099s. So you can't lie about the value of your IRAs just to try to lowball your RMD amount because the IRS gets a copy of this. They know the end of year balance of all your IRAs. Therefore, they know what your RMD is supposed to be the next year. So if you don't take at least that much distribution from your IRAs, they know you missed some RMD, and they will gladly calculate the penalty for you for having not taken enough out. So that's 5498. Now, these are one of the forms that often don't come out until late in the tax year, sometimes even after April 15th. So normally tax deadline is April 15th. This year it's April 18th because there's weekends and a holiday in there, but normally it's April 15th. 5498 often doesn't come out until after that because, remember, this reports contributions to IRAs and Roth IRAs. And you can technically make a contribution to your IRA or Roth IRA up until April 15th of the following year. So for example, here we are again, March 2023. You can still make a 2022 IRA or Roth IRA contribution even now, assuming you're eligible, you know, your income's not beyond the limits or whatever. So therefore, custodians don't know if you're done making contributions for the year because you still can now. So therefore, they often hold off sending you these things until after April 15th. Now, I'm just guessing here, but if you already made your full year's IRA contribution, let's say you did it last year, then I suspect the custodian won't hold off in sending you this because they know, okay, you already hit your annual limit for contributions. So they'll probably fire this off to you sooner rather than later instead of waiting until after April 18th. But I don't know that for a fact. That's just speculation. Okay, that's 5498. 5498-SA shows contributions to HSAs, health savings accounts. So just like 5498 normal shows IRA, Roth IRA contributions, 5498-SA shows contributions to health savings accounts. Next, 1095-A. This is for those who are on Affordable Care Act, aka ACA, aka Obamacare, aka the exchange. This is those that get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you choose to call it. You may be eligible for tax credits, in effect subsidies that help reduce the amount of premium you'd otherwise have to pay for these plans. 1095-A shows, if you are on one of these plans, it shows the total premiums paid. It shows the total credits you're eligible to get. It shows the total amount of credits you actually got prepaid to you throughout the year, and therefore shows basically a true up. If you received more credit during the year than you're supposed to get, you got to pay some of that back, and you pay it back through your tax return, or vice versa. If you received less credit than you were ultimately supposed to, you're due more back, and you get that as an additional refund or tax credit, I should say, on your tax return. Not to go too far on this, I did an episode about this before, but there will be a I just lost my train of thought. Man, that's weird. Oh, sorry. I meant to say this is income based, and this is why like the credits you get throughout the year may not be the right amount you're actually supposed to get. The train of thought again. God, come on. Oh, sorry. Anyway, so it's income based. So by the end of the year, you'll know what your actual income was on your tax return. Therefore, based on your actual income, you can reconcile the credits received versus what you estimate your income is going to be. And this, like I said, trues up the credits you need to either get more of or pay back. That's 1095-A. 1095-B, that shows minimum essential coverage, which I don't think apply. It doesn't apply federally. It does still apply at some states. So when Obamacare came out in 2013, I think it was, part of what made that system work was there was something called a shared responsibility payment, meaning everyone who was supposed to have insurance better have it. If you didn't, you had to pay. You had to pay a penalty basically for not being insured, because the whole premise was health insurance was intended to be this sort of socialized thing. Everyone needed to sort of contribute, because if you didn't, if you were healthy and needed to contribute, for example, only people who are sick and actually needed health insurance, those would be the only ones who actually, you know, were getting health insurance. And therefore, there'd be a lot less people paying into the system. So premiums would be crazy high and usage would be high, because it'd be like self-selection. Again, only people who would buy insurance would be those who are likely to need it. So there was sort of a penalty, if you want to call it that, for people who didn't have insurance but should have. They had to pay in to help support the system as a whole. That was called a shared responsibility payment. So back when this mattered, at the federal level, there used to be these penalties they would charge you. They got rid of that a handful of years ago. But this 1095-B was what showed whether or not you had the minimum level of coverage. If not, then you were subject to this shared responsibility payment. Now, some states still have it. Like New Jersey, for example, where I am, they still have a minimum shared responsibility payment, meaning if you're supposed to be insured, if you're insurable, but you don't have insurance, they can and will charge you a penalty to help support the system. So it still matters for some states. 1095-C is if you work for a large employer and you get health insurance through them. The 1095-A just simply shows whether or not you're covered through that employer. Next, 1098. This is if you have a mortgage on your house or any property for that matter, and you pay interest, the 1098 will show the interest paid. Why does that matter? Well, because you may be able to itemize your deductions, one of which is mortgage interest paid on primary residence. Next, K-1. Dun, dun, dun. This could be a lot of things. This, I'm not going to dig into this too deep, but this is any income you get from partnerships, trusts, S corporations, basically income that these separate entities have where you own a little slice of that entity. The K-1 reports your portion of that slice. So for example, you own a partnership. You and 99 other people own a partnership. The partnership collectively has, let's just say, $100 of income for the year. And every one of the 100 partners owns an equal share. Well, they're going to send out a K-1 to all 100 of the partners reporting each partner's share. So if the whole partnership at $100 of income, there's 100 partners all on equal shares. Each partner gets $1 of income reported to them on their K-1. You take that K-1, you plop it in your tax return showing your portion of that income, you know, that $1 in this case, that's ultimately taxable to you. So that's what a K-1 is. There's a lot more going on to K1s than that. They're big forms. They could be really large forms. There's a couple dozen different boxes on there that can report different things. K1s are often notoriously late in showing up. There are formal deadlines. If the entity that issued the K1, the partnership in this case, has a December 31st year end, I think they have until March 15th to get the K1s out. If they have different fiscal year ends, something other than December 31st, I think they similarly have, you know, it's 2.5 months, I guess, to get it out. So depending when in the year that is, it could really kind of monkey up you doing your return. So K1's really annoying as a tax return preparer or some that I don't have any personally, but if you have a K1s from some sort of private partnership or trust or something, you'll realize they make your tax return more complicated than you want it to be. Other things, this doesn't apply this year, but sometimes there's like special tax credits. Like there was the recovery rebate credit that was a COVID era stimulus. There was I forget the letter name now, it's old news at this point, but there was a special letter the government sent out reporting to everyone what their credits were for the year that you had to then report on your tax return. A couple other things, if you won't get a neat pretty form necessarily, but some towns, depending where you live, will send you a summary of your property tax. There'll be like here's what your property was assessed, here was a tax rate for the year, here's total taxes paid. You know, that could matter. Again, if you potentially itemize your returns, then that will matter. And you want to have that info. Now, a lot of this is public record. Even if you don't get a form from your town showing you taxes paid, in many cases, many towns that I've come across, you can go on the web and, you know, find the tax assessor site and find out your property. Again, public info, and find out your taxes paid that way. Or you probably know what you paid, especially if you paid by check or something. If you pay through a mortgage and have it deducted, it's a little less easy to find, but you can get the information that way as well. And finally, a lot of things are manual that you're not going to get reporting for. So for example, out-of-pocket medical expenses that are non-reimbursed. You know, anytime you pay a $20 copay to go to the primary care doctor, or you pay $200 for glasses or whatever, keep track of that. Medical expenses might be deductible. Again, at the federal level, if you do itemize, you could potentially get some credit for your medical expenses. Many people, they don't have enough medical expenses to qualify for, getting itemized deduction benefit. Some folks do. At the state level, you might. Using New Jersey as an example, again, at the federal level, my family and I, we don't get any direct tax credit for our medical expenses for the year. But in New Jersey, we often do, because New Jersey has a completely different boneheaded, try to be difficult tax structure than the federal system. It departs in big ways from the federal system. Any medical expenses you have in excess of 2% of your gross income are deductible in New Jersey. So there have been years where our medical expenses hit that at the state level, but did not hit at the federal level. So keep track of that, especially if you're in a state where it matters. What else? Charitable donations, depending who you paid, how much, and when, you may need to manually tabulate this stuff yourself. Now, any donation that's over 250 or maybe 250 or over needs what the IRS called contemporaneous written acknowledgement. So if you do make a donation of 250 or more, you should be getting some sort of letter or acknowledgement from the recipient organization. They may or may not send it at tax return time. Maybe they send it soon after you make the donation, but keep that if you get it. Otherwise, you have to manually track your donations. Estimated taxes paid. If you did pay estimated taxes to the federal or state level, you can find records of it online. You log into the state tax system or IRS system. Outside of that, just you got to kind of keep track manually yourself of what taxes you paid. If you're self-employed and you have small side hustle possibly in retirement, you got to keep track of all your income and expenses. Now, you may get some stuff reported. Like if you do contracting work, you may get a 1099-NEC showing the income you got from who you did the work for, but you're not going to get stuff that shows your expenses. You got to keep track of that yourself. Same thing if you have a rental property. Chances are a lot of the stuff isn't formally getting reported anywhere, at least not on formal IRS reporting means, but you got to keep track of all your income. You got to keep track of all your expenses, property taxes paid, property insurance, maintenance that you did, repairs that you did, mortgage interest, et cetera, legal services or whatever. You got to hire a realtor, find someone. That's all deductible expenses, so keep track of that. Whew. All right. Good. We cool. That's it. That's it for today. I don't know how long this is. I tried to keep this a little shorter than the last one. So hopefully you found this enjoyable. As always, if you do like this show, it'd be greatly appreciated if you take a moment to leave a review, thumbs up, star, like, in whatever podcast listening platform you use. Check out the Medicare Q&A of Boomer Benefits Facebook group. I will share a link to it in the notes to the show. Definitely give that a go. And also check out the other retirement planning education stuff. There is this podcast, obviously. There's a Facebook group. There is the YouTube channel by the same name. And the website now, retirementplanningeducation.com, that pulls all these different things together. There's a whole boatload of freely downloadable, really good, valuable stuff there. You can click and download. You don't have to cough up your name or email or anything. Just click, boom, there it is. Enjoy. That's it. Thank you as always for listening. I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.